From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Teachers leaving North Carolina classrooms are less effective than those who stay. That's one of the pieces of good news from a new report on teacher turnover. You'll learn more details. Conservatives have touted the economic benefits of tax reform in North Carolina. Now, new academic research backs up their claims. Colleges can pursue truth or they can pursue social justice. They can't pursue both. You'll learn why a recent lecturer at Duke University made that statement. Plus, we'll explore why U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas hasn't enjoyed the accolades one might expect as he marks his silver anniversary on the nation's highest court. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Like in any industry, teachers come and go from their North Carolina teaching jobs. Some even leave the profession entirely. A draft report that has been submitted to the State Board of Education looks at the data about the teaching profession in North Carolina. And our Dr. Terry Stoops is here to tell us what is in that draft report. He is the Director of Research and Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
The narrative that we have heard for months and months now is that teachers are leaving our state by the thousands. Are they really?
No, not really. And it's interesting that we're hearing this narrative because I went and looked at what was talked about when the teacher turnover report would be released under Democratic administrations. And it's really interesting that this kind of alarm wasn't raised when the Democrats were in charge. Instead, it was a lot of talk about we'll do better next year and we'll have program X or Y in place to make sure teachers stay. But since the Republicans have taken over and Governor McCrory has taken over the governor's mansion, the narrative has been that Republican policies are pushing teachers away, and it's just not true.
So what do we know about the profession in this draft report? Certainly, there are some teachers who are leaving the state of North Carolina. What do we know about them?
Well, overall, teachers are leaving for personal reasons. This idea that teachers are looking at statewide policies or various other things that are going on in the education policy realm is a real myth. I mean, they're leaving because they weren't suited for the classroom. They had a spouse that moved to another state. They retired. Very few teachers are making the decision to leave North Carolina to teach in another state. In fact, when you look at the overall teaching workforce, less than 1% of our teacher workforce decides to go teach in another state. And that's the one thing that we hear a lot about, especially in the media, is that we're pushing teachers to other states that pay more. Well, in some cases, yes, in some cases, no, but I find that there really isn't a lot we can do in most cases to keep teachers here that would leave for another state.
It sounds as if teachers are just like the rest of us who aren't teachers, that there are personal reasons that you might move out of state or personal reasons that you might not like your work environment. And in some cases, maybe some of those really, really politically active folks are indeed leaving because they don't like the policies under the Republicans. But it just doesn't sound like it's some major issue that North Carolina should be concerned about.
It's not. Our attrition rate, that is the teachers that leave the classroom, is around 9%. And that's comparable to a lot of private sector industries. It's comparable to the nonprofit sector. And actually, it's pretty common, a common percentage amongst other states. And we find that, the fact that 9% is leaving can be a good thing. And the way we know that it's a good thing, especially in this report, because they looked at the effectiveness of teachers that left the classroom. And that's a key addition that has been made because of the North Carolina General Assembly and Governor McCrory deciding that the teacher turnover report that we've had in the past was misleading and didn't have a whole lot of information. They passed legislation that would ensure that we looked at the effectiveness of teachers that are leaving the classroom.
What did we find?
Well, we found exactly what I suspected and have been talking about for years, is that teachers that leave North Carolina classrooms are less effective than those who stay. That's an absolutely critical finding. And let me just reiterate that the only reason why we know that is because the General Assembly and Governor McCrory decided that we needed a better teacher turnover report. And so they ordered the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction to look at the effectiveness of teachers that are leaving. They found that they're less effective. And to be honest, I want less effective teachers to leave our classroom. If our goal is to give a quality education to every child, that means we should have an effective teacher in every classroom. And our less effective teachers, I don't want them anywhere near our classroom. And so if they're leaving for other states or if they're leaving for other industries, other professions, that's fine by me.
When you say effective and that those leaving are less effective, how do we define effectiveness?
They define effectiveness as growth. So are the teachers that are staying and leaving providing 1 year's worth of academic growth for these students? So it's not based on necessarily just straight up test scores or proficiency rates. Are the students that are taking classes with these teachers growing as much as they should? And we find that teachers that are leaving are not growing as much as those who have classes with those who are staying. And this is one of the advantages of looking at growth, is that we can attribute the performance of students when we look at growth to the teacher, because we're only talking about a 1 year time frame and we're not talking about what's happened in the past and everything that a kid is bringing with them to the classroom.
Are we seeing any trends in the data of the folks who are leaving the North Carolina classroom? Are they young teachers? Are they people who've been in the system 20 or 30 years? What do we know about them, other than their effectiveness being lower than those who are staying?
Well, we find that in the first 5 years is really the period where we have the highest turnover rate, where the most individuals leave the classroom. And that's understandable. People go in there thinking that they want to teach. They find out the realities of teaching are not what they expected, and so they leave. So we expect attrition in that first 5 years. But here is the important part to note, is that the Republican General Assembly, Governor McCrory, recognized that our highest attrition was in the first 5 years. And so what they did was they decided to focus pay increases on that first 5 years, to the point where no teacher starting in the profession will make less than $35,000 a year. And most teachers actually make more than that when you add a local supplement. They saw that the problem was in the first 5 years, and they addressed it by increasing pay to ensure that those good teachers that are having a difficult time in the first 5 years stay in the classroom, and that their financial situation is not dire, that instead they're giving a good basis from which to start and a good incentive to stay in the classroom.
Terry, you've been a teacher yourself. When you first went into the classroom, what is it that you found that maybe you didn't expect? Because you're saying that some of these early year teachers, it's not what they thought it was going to be. What's different?
It's exhausting, for one. I think most teachers don't realize just how exhausting it is to teach four or five classes a day and 130 students. But, you know, the other part about it is that much of what a teacher does is not only communicate content, but they have to make sure that the classroom is an orderly one. And so classroom management is a critical part of a teacher's job that isn't necessarily something that a teacher that comes out of a teacher education program would have a lot of experience or a lot of background in learning ways to make sure that the classroom is kept orderly so that you can communicate the content that's required.
How do you better prepare someone to be an effective teacher?
Well, I think getting them in the classroom is absolutely critical, ensuring that we have a teacher education program that gets teacher candidates into the classroom, whether it be for some sort of internship or student teaching, that would allow them to practice those things that they learn in the classroom. I think it's absolutely critical that we take a better approach to training them with practical means rather than theoretical means in the classroom, giving them that practical experience.
Does that mean we need some changes perhaps to the curriculum in our teacher education schools on our campuses?
I mean, absolutely. We've needed that for several decades. It's probably the hardest thing to change is our teacher education programs. And I think this is going to be something that the next General Assembly, that the governor is definitely going to look at in making those changes that are necessary to ensure every child has a quality classroom.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Director of Research and Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. We've been talking about this teacher turnover report. You can read Terry's analysis of the report at carolinajournal.com and johnlocke.org. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has seen a number of education reforms in recent years. No more cap on the number of public charter schools, new scholarships for low-income and special needs students. But that doesn't mean the work is over. Our next guest recently addressed the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on the theme, The Future of Education Reform in North Carolina. Lisa Snell is Director of Education for the Reason Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So North Carolina really has seen quite a few education reforms in recent years. As someone who monitors education and how it stands across the country, has North Carolina been a pretty good example in recent years?
Absolutely, especially this last legislative short session. You know, in the country, there's about 60 private school choice programs where public dollars can follow kids to the private school of their parents' choice. And North Carolina has two of those programs, one, as you mentioned, for low-income students and one for special needs students. And you know, up until now, there was a huge demand with about 22,000 kids on a waiting list for the Opportunity Scholarship for the low-performing schools. And so the last session, they just improved a huge increase over the next 10 years in the number of students so that every year that program could grow. And so that's good news. And, you know, the Milton Friedman Foundation just released a big study on school vouchers called the Win-Win Solution that looked at private school choice. And they looked at over 100 studies, but 30 of them were like gold standard with random assignment. You know, and they found that all of the studies, both in terms of performance for the public schools and those students in the private school choice, found no negative effects. And they also found that nationwide we're saving $1.7 billion in taxpayer money by using private school vouchers for some kids. So North Carolina's and then later we can talk about the Achievement School District because I think that's important too.
I was just going to say that's another thing that we saw that was new during the session that you just referenced was the creation of this Achievement School District for five of the lowest performing elementary schools in North Carolina. As someone who follows these issues across the country, what sort of promise does that have?
Right. So for North Carolina, I think that's a modest start for low-performing schools. But New Orleans is probably the best example that's sort of close by. And they in that city, there's 100% schools that are charter schools that are managed by nonprofit private organizations. And they used they called it the Recovery School District, but basically exactly the same model as the Achievement School District, where low-performing schools were placed in state care, and then they used outside organizations basically to manage those care. And that's been going on since 2005 after Hurricane Katrina. And New Orleans is the fastest improving urban city in the country, and across a wide range of indicators, whether it's graduation rates or performance for all subgroups like African American and special education students, they've seen tremendous growth. So their ACT scores have gone from like the 20th percentile to the 50th percentile in a small number of years. There's just a huge study that found like a 4% effect size for achievement for these reforms, and that's much bigger than like universal preschool or small class size or other popular reforms that have much smaller improvements for student achievement. So on the whole, you know, it's a positive direction. Also, Memphis, Tennessee has had some good results with this. So, I mean, I think it's always good to take lower performing schools and mix it up a little bit and let some new blood come in and think of innovative ideas for kids.
We're chatting with Lisa Snell, who is Director of Education at the Reason Foundation. So after patting lawmakers on the back for what they did during this most recently concluded session, what are some of the things that they ought to be looking at in the future?
Right. I mean, I think there's two big things that could be helpful to North Carolina. And the first is just thinking about how school finance has done in the state overall, because North Carolina is one of a very few states that actually gives school districts or local education agencies positions and programs instead of actually money for kids and letting them decide at the local level. And so just thinking about how money is distributed and how it's attached to where kids actually enroll, I think will be a big challenge for the state of North Carolina. And they're completely out of sync with every other state in terms of how their funding is distributing. And for school choice moving forward, having money attached to kids is a big school choice enabler, if your funding formula is right. And then the second thing that I'll just wrap up with is education savings accounts, which is taking hold nationwide. And that's the idea of giving parents a bank account or a debit card with their per pupil funding attached and letting them, you know, they could use a tutor or a private school. They could use online classes from MIT. They could have, you know, an occupational therapist, whatever their child needed. And then they, if they have an incentive to save, they could roll that money over that's left toward future years of education or toward their kid's college savings account. And Nevada has a statewide program that every kid is eligible for. That could be the first universal choice program where the parents truly manage all the resources of their child's education.
You mentioned this funding issue. For those who don't follow this very closely, why is the way North Carolina funds the school districts, why does that cause a challenge for leading to reform?
Because it's very difficult to allocate. So if you wanted to move to a more choice-based system or have more open enrollment, it's very hard to do that if you give districts or schools positions or teachers or program funding instead of student funding. And it also increases inequity in states like North Carolina, because then the money tends to follow the employees instead of the children. So then you have schools or districts where it's more desirable to work, or you might not have as much challenges. And this isn't intentional. It's just an unintended consequence that money then flows to the schools with the most experienced staff, the schools with the most savvy program officers that can get new programming, and then the schools with new teachers or the most disadvantaged students or the least desirable in some ways places to work end up with fewer resources. And so it just tends to be a very centralized way that the state actually tells each school what teachers they should have, what programs they should have, instead of giving them the money based on the students that enroll, which is how charter schools and voucher programs in the state of North Carolina work, and then letting the local school decide on what is the priority for their school and the principal to have more autonomy to manage that those resources.
In the time we have remaining, you mentioned two potential reforms. One, we were just talking about with the funding, and also the education savings accounts or ESAs. How tough would those be to put in place?
I mean, really, I think education savings accounts is where we're all going, because in the future, the reality is that everything is becoming more personalized. And so our traditional model of, you know, the factory model of schools with one teacher and 30 students – I just can't imagine 25 years from now that we're still going to be doing education that way, because technology allows us to personalize. And so you may have kids taking half a day at a community college and half their day at the local high school, or, you know, being in formal education for 2 hours and then using personalized computers. And so you really need to manage the resources based on the students to move into the next level of personalized education in America, which is where everything is going, even if there's resistance at this point.
Well, we know one person who's going to be watching this entire process very closely is Lisa Snell. She is Director of Education for the Reason Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has cut tax rates and adjusted unemployment benefits in recent years, the goal boosting the state's economy. How well has it worked? High Point University economist Stephanie Crofton tackled that question. She co-authored a recent report for the Civitas Institute.
To estimate the impact of North Carolina's recent policy changes, we measured the average relationships between key economic policies and key measures of economic performance across the 50 states and the District of Columbia during 2000 to 2015. Our analysis shows that states with lower sales taxes, income taxes, and lower and shorter unemployment insurance benefits experienced higher economic growth, employment growth, and wage growth, and lower unemployment rates.
What does that mean for North Carolina?
Applying our cross-state findings to North Carolina, we conclude that recent policy changes in our state already have had the following effects. reducing sales taxes, increased employment by 11,000 jobs, state GDP by $1.4 billion, and wages by $800 million between 2011 and 2015. Reforming income taxes in 2013 increased employment by 8,800 jobs, state GDP by $800 million, and wages by $320 million between 2013 and 2015. Reducing maximum unemployment insurance benefits increased employment by 35,000 jobs, state GDP by $6.3 billion, and wages by $1.26 billion between 2012 and 2015. And further, reduced the unemployment rate by 0.6 percentage point in 2013. Reducing the maximum number of weeks of regular unemployment insurance benefits increased employment by 88,000 jobs and reduced the unemployment rate by 1 percentage point between 2012 and 2015. Over a 10-year period, we project in our study that North Carolina's recent policy changes will have even larger effects as job and income growth continue to climb higher than they would have without the reforms.
What's the conclusion?
In our study, we confirm the long-standing findings in economic theory that higher taxes and higher and longer unemployment insurance benefits detract from economic growth, employment growth, and wage growth. Undoing the policy changes of recent years would harm both North Carolina's ongoing recovery and North Carolinians' long-term economic and employment prospects.
That's High Point University economist Stephanie Crofton. She's detailing her recent report on the economic benefits of North Carolina's recent tax and unemployment reforms. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. For centuries, universities have focused on pursuing truth. But Jonathan Haidt, a philosopher and professor at the New York University Business School, says the situation has changed over the past couple of decades. Haidt recently spoke at Duke University. He said the pursuit of social justice has changed universities in recent years.
To the extent that this was broadening what we study, broadening the people studying, broadening the canon that undergrads read, the books that they read, this is all to the good. I'm very happy about those changes. But I think this set in motion in the 90s a set of changes that are resonating today and that can help explain what happened last fall all around the country and the very rapid transformation that's occurring this year and last year.
Haidt says now truth and social justice stand as competing goals in higher education.
No university can pursue both. Individuals can in their own lives, but a university needs to have a central mission, and it has to be either truth or social justice. It can't be both. And so I'm going to argue that we need a schism. We need our universities to clearly declare which way you're going. You can go either way. It's a free country, but you got to go one way or the other, and you have to be explicit about it, advertise that, and then students can choose which kind of university to go to.
Haidt's case included a focus on how social justice distorts scientific pursuit of truth.
There's a really, really deep problem in the social sciences, which is that every one of us, everyone in every social science department knows that correlation does not imply causation. We know this so deeply that, I mean, we never let each other get away with it. If you're at a cocktail party and somebody who's not a social scientist says something, you know, like we can't stop ourselves saying, well, but correlation doesn't imply causation. And if we're dreaming and someone in my dream, I correct them in my dreams, like we all know this. So here's a graph. So autism, as autism has been going up since the 90s, so has organic food sales. What do you think? Do you think that autism is caused by organic food? Or do you think that it's autistic people who buy organic food and that's why they go up? Which is it? And if you're a social scientist, probably neither. That's just a correlation. There's a lot of ways to explain that. Here's another one I just found from Googling. More buck for your bang. People who have more sex make the most money. So what do you think? Do you think that if you're currently in a relationship and you have more sex, your income will go up? Do you think that's the way it works? Of course not. There's a third variable. So a social scientist would instantly say, what's the third variable? And the third variable is extroversion and openness to experience. People who have that trait have more sex and make more money. Okay? Third, we know this. We all know this. But suddenly you present people with a disparity and they all say, oh my God, causation. The fact that that person is a woman is why she wasn't hired. All we have is a correlation between gender and outcomes, but we impute causation and we know the causation is discrimination. Could be individual or it could be systemic, but it's discrimination.
That's New York University professor Jonathan Haidt speaking recently at Duke University. He went on to contrast the way a truth university and a social justice university would approach the same data.
At social justice U, they teach you that if a group is underrepresented, it proves, or at least strongly suggests, that there is systemic or structural discrimination against that group. That is what you learn at SJU. Now, this is wrong. This is just flat out wrong. There's no defense of, I shouldn't say there's no defense. I'm sure someone will have a defense. But I believe this is wrong. At Truth University, we teach you that correlation does not imply causation. In fact, this is such an important lesson, I want you all to say it out loud with me right now. I'll say one, two, three, and say it. Say one, two, three. Correlation does not imply causation. Thank you. So please remember that and spout that back to your professors when they violate that. Now, I do not want to deny that there is racism and sexism. I do not want to deny the indignities that women and especially African Americans feel. I read the stories from my students. I'm not saying everything is fine. But what I'm saying is to simply argue that a disparity shows systemic anything is wrong. It's an invitation to look more closely. By all means, look more closely. We need social justice activists to commit themselves to look more closely. That's great. That's necessary. And sometimes they find it.
So what happens when discrimination claims are put to the test? Haidt looked at one case involving hiring of female professors in science-related fields.
Ultimately, the most powerful test is an experimental manipulation. And so one was done. Williams and Cece at Cornell, they made up all kinds of resumes that showed equivalent levels of research success and productivity. They sent them out to faculty in STEM fields, and they looked, figured, and they found out who was shortlisted for an interview. And what do you think happened? Yes, there was bias. Which way do you think it went? Everybody is on the left. Everybody is really concerned about getting women into science. Everybody's really concerned about gender inequality, racial inequality. So of course these professors would prefer to bring the woman in. They've been trying since the 90s to equalize things. So of course, if you're applying and you're a woman, of course you have an advantage. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I understand that. That's fine. But to then say that the disparity shows that the STEM fields are systemically sexist gets it exactly backwards. They're systemically anti-sexist. And so the next time anyone, especially one of your professors, tells you that some disparity shows a violation of social justice, what I want you to say is disparate outcomes do not imply disparate treatment.
Why does social justice cause problems for those who want to pursue truth?
It's very hard to understand exactly what the definition of social justice is, but I think there are two parts to it. So social justice activists are very focused on disparate treatment of individuals, and that is a subtype of justice. That is good. Everybody should agree that that is a thing to focus on. If people are treated differently because they are black or gay or female, that is wrong. That is an outrage. That should stop. Somebody should stop it. But there's another part of social justice. Social justice, as I experience it, as I hear it, as I read about it, it is not mostly about disparate treatment. It is mostly about disparate outcomes. And when social justice is focused on achieving equal outcomes for all groups, then it's no longer a subset of justice. Part of it is justice. Part of it is outside of justice.
Outside of justice? Haidt offered an example to explain his point.
In 2014, the Obama administration, Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights, noticed that punishment rates are very disparate by race. This is true. And so the Civil Rights Act prohibits such discrimination, and they tell schools that they must eliminate their disparities. They send one of their infamous Dear Colleague letters warning schools, you better even the rates out or we're coming after you. And so the Minneapolis Public Schools, the administrator, the head of the public schools, comes up with a new plan that's going to make it much more difficult to suspend children of color. And, of course, they're going to try to crack down on the white and Asian kids because they got to get those rates equal. So what do you think? We know that the black and Latino violation rate is higher, not just from the corresponding crime rates outside of school, but just from the fact that boys raised without marriage, boys raised with men cycling through the home, have many more behavior problems. So we know that the rates are different. And if the goal is to equalize the rates of punishment, is that fair? This is an abomination from the point of view of fairness or justice to do that. And that's why I say that when social justice, as I see it, as we practice in this country, when social justice demands equal treatment, it is justice, it is right, it is good. And when it demands equal outcomes without concern for inputs or differences, it is unjust. And the only way to achieve those equal outcomes is through injustice.
That's why Professor Jonathan Haidt is calling for a schism in higher education. He wants universities to state clearly whether they want to pursue truth or social justice. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. He is the most quiet and reserved U.S. Supreme Court justice who currently sits on the High Court, and that has given critics of Justice Clarence Thomas one more thing to critique. But our next guest says that the double standard applied to Thomas has recently been the focus of a national columnist. Here to discuss it is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies and attorney himself, John Guzet. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna. It's great to be here.
Now, I'm really starting to feel old because I actually remember the Justice Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, and that was 25 years ago.
I remember that was quite a spectacle. I was in law school at the time.
What's your memory of that those hearings?
Well, I was really distressed because I was so excited about Thomas's nomination. I'd read some of what he'd written in the past, and I thought he was the most attractive nominee in my lifetime. Anyway, I was very excited about it.
And the fact that he is African-American and he was considered to be a conservative, perhaps a constitutionalist, that made him all the more unique a nominee at the time.
That's right. It made him even that much more attractive, I guess.
So why were those hearings so contentious?
Well, it was entirely because of this testimony by Anita Hill. She sort of emerged from nowhere with this yarn about how he had sexually harassed her when she was working for him. Earlier, and she repeated verbatim some of the things that she claimed he had said to her, and although it seems tame in retrospect, at the time it was just shocking because of the explicit sexual nature of some of these comments.
Now, over the years, Justice Thomas has developed a reputation of of being very quiet, as I mentioned. And a few months ago, he actually asked a question at oral argument, and that itself made news. But over the years, he has been the subject of criticism and critique. And recently, there's been writing by one particular columnist who says this is just all a huge double standard. Tell us about that and why it caught your attention.
Well, it is a double standard. It's something I've written about myself. This slur that Thomas is lazy or not doing his job, which are things that have been explicitly said about him, is just a complete lie. He's the hardest working justice on the court. There's no question about it. He writes more dissents and longer dissents than anybody. He's actually quite prolific and huge work ethic and commitment to doing his job well.
Why is it that a national columnist has taken to writing about Justice Clarence Thomas over the past few weeks?
Well, this gentleman, and let me just remind myself of his name.
I believe he was writing for The Federalist, writing some columns about Justice Clarence Thomas. And that's really caught your attention, John.
Right. Mark Pauletta. I think he used to clerk for Thomas. He's been following his career for a long time, and he's written about him in other contexts. But lately, he's been pretty incensed, and with good reason, in my opinion, by a couple of things that happened. The first was a column by Maureen Dowd. She said the same thing that you and I have been saying, which is how shocking it was to hear those criticisms of Thomas when he was having his hearings in the Senate. But she also implies or actually says that he was guilty, and that's just completely unreasonable to say that. There's not a slightest bit of evidence that Anita Hill was telling the truth. All the other witnesses, and there were many, many of them, came forward and said they never heard Justice Thomas say anything like that. There were inconsistencies in her story. There were inconsistencies in the lady that brought her to the Senate in the first place. So at the very least, this should be one of those things where we don't know what happened, and all the evidence suggests that Anita Hill was lying and Clarence Thomas never said these things.
This was 25 years ago that she made those allegations, and the story has dogged Justice Thomas. And in fact, now it's actually become a current story because of the opening of a brand new historical museum in Washington. Tell us about that.
Well, that's the new and highly acclaimed Museum of African American History and Culture. It's meant to document all the important events and people in the history of African Americans in this country. But as Mark points out in a different column, the only reference to Clarence Thomas in the entire museum is appears in an exhibit that's actually about Anita Hill. So they give Anita Hill a lot of space in their exhibits, but they only mention Clarence Thomas in the derogatory sense of being the person who harassed her and led to certain improvements in sexual harassment law as a result.
That's really astonishing, considering his stature, his background, the fact that he's been on the court for 25 years, that he's a conservative African-American. Why in the world would he be essentially left out, except for in that derogatory sense, of this historical museum?
Well, the left has always hated him. I mean, they would hate any justice who took such an originalist and, in some people's view, a conservative view of the Constitution. But they hate him especially because he's black. They simply cannot tolerate the idea that a black man isn't towing the progressive line that they think black men ought to tow.
I know that these two columns that you mentioned by this gentleman writing for The Federalist really caught your attention and focused you on this. But I also know that as an attorney and legal expert yourself, that you read these U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Tell us what you make of Justice Thomas's writings.
His writing, I think, is the most interesting on the court. I mean, I love Justice Scalia. All of us on the right and in the libertarian wing of political thinking loved him. But Clarence Thomas is the most interesting. He's the most strictly originalist, and he's the boldest thinker. He's willing to challenge ideas that have been accepted for decades. What he likes to say when people criticize him for this is that while he respects the court's precedents, he respects the Constitution more. And I think that's the line a Supreme Court justice ought to take, but he's the only one who's really been able to go all the way with that.
Now, you said that he challenges things. What kinds of concepts or precedents does he challenge that some people might find really unusual?
Well, actually, there was this just happened very recently in a case from Texas having to do with restrictions on abortion. What Clarence Thomas did there, in addition to criticizing the majority's opinion on some technical grounds, was he looked at the underlying theory of that case. And what the rest of the justices were doing, as Supreme Court justices have done for decades, is applying a hierarchy of standards that means that, for instance, commercial transactions are deserving of less scrutiny from the court than free speech. Abortion sort of falls in between there. It's what they call intermediate scrutiny. But Clarence Thomas says this whole system of tiers of scrutiny, there's nothing in the Constitution about that. The question should be, does this citizen have a constitutional right? And if he does, was that constitutional right violated? That's a very original and bold thing to do at this point in constitutional jurisprudence.
Now, John, you mentioned that Justice Scalia passed away a few months ago, so the next president will be nominating at least one new member, perhaps two or three members of the U.S. Supreme Court. What qualities would you look for were you nominating someone for the Supreme Court?
Well, if I could be making the choice, there's three things I would want to see. I would want to find somebody who believes in the rule of law. That is to say, we have laws, and they apply to everybody, including people who are part of the government. Secondly, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and that law applies to everybody. And finally, that they would believe that the laws have meaning, and that meaning can be discovered based on the written language of the laws. So we want originalism, we want textualism, and we want respect for the rule of law.
We've been talking with John Guzet. He is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies. That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.